put up on the screen. You guys can all throw up at the end of the message or in the middle, whichever you prefer. So I just wanted to share this with you because Amanda worked really diligently and hard on it, and it's just a really, really cool communion graphic for it with the motion and stuff like that. And so when I did the There's a Redeemer thing, you didn't get to see this, but I wanted you to see it and all that, so there it is. All right, now you can throw up the title slide for us again. So the word entitlement means a couple of different things. One of them is, according to Apple's development director, so Apple iPhones, you guys with me on the Apple thing, it is a Boolean value that indicates whether an app can provide usernames and passwords for autofill in Safari and other apps. Now, I have no idea what a Boolean value is. I do know what autofill and Safari and apps and passwords are, so that doesn't really help me figure out what the entitlement part of what Paul wrote is. A couple of other definitions will help us get there, though. One is the right to benefits or something that is granted by law or contract. Another one is the belief that someone is deserving of special treatment or privileges, especially when little or nothing has been done to deserve it. These last two make a connection to what the early church leader Paul wrote about in Romans. He had written about how people are made right with God through faith and not the law, and it didn't matter whether you were Jew or Gentile, that being made right with God was available for all through faith, whether Jew or Gentile. And this caused a problem for the Jewish people, because the Jewish people believed that they were entitled to right relationship with God because they were Jewish. And a Gentile could be not entitled, but could be offered right relationship with God if they would convert and become Jewish. If God would allow the Gentiles to become right with him through faith without becoming Jewish, did that then mean that God had abandoned the Jews and that God had not kept his promises and could not be trusted to keep his promises? That was the tension that was experienced around what Paul was writing. And so Paul writes this part of his letter to talk about this idea of entitlement. The Jews had become so entitled that they actually ran the risk of no longer being included. And Paul unpacks this in this part of his letter to make it clear. And so here we go. He says, "With Christ as my witness, I speak with utter truthfulness. My conscience and the Holy Spirit confirms it." Paul has told them very clearly that right relationship with God is through faith. Doesn't matter Jew or Gentile. And here, though the pushback has come, he gets a three-prong approach to validating what he's saying. He says, number one, Christ is his witness. Though Paul was considered one of the best of the best of the Jews when he was Jewish, he served on the highest ruling council. The early part of his ministry was set out to persecute Christians and put an end to the movement known as the Jesus Way. And then when he had a personal encounter with Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, that changed for him, and everything changed for him, and he set out to advance the Jesus mission. And so he says he had been accused of being a traitor by the Jews, and he said, "Jesus is my witness that what I have said to you is true. I speak with utter truthfulness. You can confirm the things that I talk about." And he says, "My conscience and my spirit confirm it." So there's three things that he's using to validate his messaging to the church. And then he goes on to say, "My heart is filled with bitter sorrow and unending grief for my people, my Jewish brothers and sisters. I would be willing to be forever cursed, cut off from Christ, if that would save them." So Paul has been accused of being a traitor, of no longer caring about the Jewish people, about only caring about the Gentiles. And he says, that's not the case. He said, I am filled with bitter sorrow and unending grief for my Jewish brothers and sisters. And if he were not concerned, if he was not caring, if he was not compassionate toward them, I don't think that he would make the offer to be forever cursed. I don't think that he would make the offer to be cut off from Christ after all that meant for him, if that would be what it would take to bring his fellow Jews to an understanding of what it means to be made right with God, not through the law, but through faith. And then he goes on to say, they are the people of Israel, chosen to be God's adopted children. And remember from last week that adopted children hold the same rights as a biological child. And not only that, but as adopted children of God, we are also co-heirs with Christ. So there's a lot of unpacking that's there. He said, God revealed his glory to them. He made covenants with them and gave them his law. Hold that slide right there for me. He says, he revealed his glory. This would have referred to what the Jewish people called God's Shekinah glory. And it was considered the presence of God that rested on the Ark of the Covenant and filled the tabernacle when they were in their time during the wilderness. And it was his glory in a visible, manifest presence to them. And so he has revealed his glory to them. He made covenants with them. Covenants like the covenant he made with Abraham, that he would make his name great, that his descendants would be as numerous as the stars in the sky and as numerous as the sands on the seashore, that he would be given a land to call home. He made covenant with Moses through the law. He made covenant with David that the Davidic dynasty will always be in place. There will always be a king that will sit on the throne of Israel in the line of David. And then he gave them his law, the law given to Moses in the wilderness. Go ahead and go to the next slide for me. He gave them the privilege of worshiping him and receiving his wonderful promises. In other words, God had given the nation of Israel, God had given the Jewish people enough to know, enough to be confident, enough to be sure, enough to understand what being made right with God is all about. They took what they knew and they turned it into a form of entitlement that said, because we are Jewish, we are entitled to right relationship with God, even, and sometimes especially if that means to the exclusion of others. And he goes on to say, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are their ancestors. Abraham, the patriarch of the promise. Isaac, his son. Jacob, the lesser, chosen over the greater. And Christ himself was an Israelite. Jesus was born Jewish in the line of David, in the line of Abraham, as far as his human nature is concerned. And he is God. So not only is he Jewish, but he is God in human form, the one who rules over everything and is worthy of eternal praise. And you all say it together. Well then, has God failed to fulfill his promise to Israel? No, for not all who are born into the nation of Israel are truly members of God's people. In other words, there is no entitlement. There is no just because you're Jewish, you're in, and just because they're not Jewish, they're not. It was not God who failed to fulfill his promise. It was the nation of Israel who failed to uphold their end of the covenant agreement between God and the nation of Israel. And he says, not all who are born into the nation of Israel are truly members of God's people, which means there must be some other term, some other condition, some other mechanism, some other avenue, some other way to be truly a member of God's people. And it isn't being Jewish. Go ahead. Being descendants of Abraham doesn't make them truly Abraham's children. Isaac was the child of the promise. Abraham had other children. He had a son by the name of Ishmael through Sarah's maidservant Hagar. But Ishmael was not a child of the promise. They had other children through a woman by the name of Keturah. They were not children of the promise, but yet they were Abraham's descendants. And all who would follow Ishmael and the children of Keturah would be descendants of Abraham, but they weren't truly Abraham's children. They were in a biological sense, but not in a sense of the promise. Go ahead. For the scriptures say, Isaac is the son through whom your descendants will be counted. In other words, Isaac is the descendant of the promise. And the descendants of the promise come through Isaac, not through Ishmael, not through the children of Keturah. Though Abraham had other children too. Abraham had many children. And for those of you that grew up in church or have a lot of background experience, there are a couple of you that are looking at each other right now talking about it, saying, Father Abraham had many sons had Father Abraham. How many of you were thinking it? How many of you were looking at each other talking about it? You know you were. So now, instead of having the song, There's a Redeemer in your head all day, you will have the song, Father Abraham, in your head all day long. I'm using the screen so much that I'm losing the scriptures on my iPad. Where are we at? Well, don't change it on me. How can I figure out where we are if you change it on me? I don't have any notes on here. I just have the scriptures. And so I've been using those so much. Okay. This means that Abraham's descendants are not necessarily children of God. They may be biological children, but they may not be descendants of the promise. Only the children of the promise are considered to be Abraham's children. Do you see that it is better to be included than entitled? They had held on to their sense of entitlement so strongly that they missed the mark of what it means to be made in right relationship with God, because they were so focused on the law and their descendancy and their heritage and all of that, that they lost sight of what it meant to live by faith. And faith was the metric for God, not being Jew. In fact, he opened it up and said, anyone who has faith. So go ahead, next slide for me. For God has promised, I will return about this time next year, and Sarah will have a son. Abraham already had a son. And it was named Ishmael, because they had taken matters into their own hands. But when all seemed hopeless, when all seemed lost, when all seemed impossible, God gave confidence and assurance that he would be a promise keeper, not just a promise maker, and that Sarah would have a son, and it was through Isaac, her son, through which the promise would be fulfilled. And interestingly enough, the original part of the promise, when God made a promise to Abraham, was that Sarah would have a son through whom the promise would be fulfilled. And now God's coming full circle and reminding him of what the original promise was. Go ahead. This son was our ancestor Isaac. When he married Rebekah, she gave birth to twins. Now, there could have been an argument in some that said, well, Isaac is the son of the promise and Ishmael isn't, because they had different moms. That because Hagar was Ishmael's mom and Sarah was Isaac's mom, that's the difference. And so you're choosing still based on biological heritage, just through this line and not this line. That could have been the argument that was there. So what Paul does here is he goes beyond Abraham and Sarah to Isaac and Rebekah and their children, who happened to be named Jacob and Esau. Now, in the first century culture, it was the firstborn that was the entitled child. The firstborn son specifically was entitled to the favored role, the favored position, the inheritance, and it was all of that that was geared towards the firstborn. And so when Rebekah gave birth to twins, she gave birth to Jacob and Esau. Esau was the firstborn, Jacob was the secondborn. Let's see what happens. But before they were born, in other words, before there was a firstborn, before there was any sense of entitlement, before they had done anything good or bad, she received a message from God, she being Rebekah. She received a message. This message shows that God chooses people according to his own purposes. Not about entitlement, not about ancestry, not about lineage, not about firstborn, secondborn, but not according to their good or bad works. She was told, your older son will serve your younger son. In other words, Esau will be subservient to Jacob, which was the exact opposite of everything that culture considered. In the words of scriptures, I loved Jacob, but I rejected Esau. This is about the process and the path of being made right with God. That he didn't pick based on entitlement. In the culture, Esau would have been the entitled one as the firstborn. God says, that's not the way it works. I am going to do it this way. Why? Because I'm God. That's the best answer I can give you. Because I'm God. And when he says rejected Esau, this isn't that he rejected Esau as a person. It isn't that he rejected Esau as an individual. It's that he rejected Esau as the path to being made right with God, so that it would flip it all upside down and people would say, this isn't about entitlement, this is about being included. Now, I don't want to read too much into the narrative, and I certainly don't want to misinterpret anything, but I wonder if there would have been any point in time where Esau could have humbled himself and accepted the promise and been subservient to Jacob all along the way. All right. Are we saying then that God was unfair? Of course we are. Of course. That's not what he's saying at all. So here's this, of course not. Would it have been fair to include the Jews and exclude the Gentiles? Would it have been fair of a loving and just and right God to select people for entitlement, to select people because of their race? Would it have been fair to say, the firstborn's in and the secondborn's out, just because you were born first? Would that have been fair? Here's the deal. This isn't any more or less fair. It's just less ambiguous. It's clear. And sometimes we like clear. But the thing about it is, what we think is so clear is what we've muddied up because of our human sinful nature. We muddied up what God has made abundantly clear in his perfect, just, and right, and true character. And so we're the ones that step back. This was the first line of argument. Isn't this unfair? Of course not. It's actually more unfair your way than it is God's way. For God said to Moses, I will show mercy to anyone I choose, and I will show compassion to anyone I choose. So when God says, I'm going to show mercy and compassion to the Gentiles, you Jews have no right to complain and gripe and claim it's unfair, because you've done a pretty good job of screwing up the path of the law anyway. It's almost like when it comes to this, God is going to say, I will show mercy and compassion to anyone who places their trust in me. Whether they are Jew or Gentile, whether they are firstborn or secondborn, none of that matters. What matters to me is I will show mercy and compassion to anyone who places trust in me. And that's not about entitlement. That's about being included. Go ahead. So, it is God who decides to show mercy. We can neither choose it nor work for it. We can't earn right relationship with God. It is given to us. We cannot choose God's mercy. God's mercy is given. We can choose to accept or reject, just as most of the Jews chose to reject Jesus as the Messiah, though they should have known. But we don't choose who and whether God extends his mercy. We're just the recipients of it. Go ahead. For the scriptures say that God told Pharaoh. So now Paul goes all the way back to the time around the Exodus, one of the pivotal points in the nation of Israel's history when they had been slaves in Egypt for over 400 years, cried out to God to rescue, God heard their cries and sent Moses to confront the ruler of Egypt, Pharaoh, about letting God's people go. It says, for the scriptures say that God told Pharaoh, I have appointed you for the very purpose of displaying my power in you and to spread my fame throughout the earth. Pharaoh had many reasons to reject God and Moses' appeal to let the people go. The primary one was the condition of Pharaoh's heart, the prideful condition of Pharaoh's heart, where he felt he had the right to do anything he wanted, regardless of anything or anyone else. And God said that he's going to use the condition of Pharaoh's heart and the position of Pharaoh's royalty for the very purpose of displaying his power. So then God sent plagues. Then God did this. God showed signs through Moses and Aaron and through the world around Egypt and all that. And everything came. And to spread my fame throughout the earth. Here's the deal. We still talk about the plagues, right? We still talk about what happened to the nation of Israel in and around the Exodus of Egypt, right? And we still talk about the God who was behind the plagues, the God who was behind the Exodus, and the God who led Israel through. He has made his name, his fame, spread throughout the earth through the hard heart of Pharaoh. Go ahead. So you see, God chooses to show mercy to some, and he chooses to harden the hearts of others so they refuse to listen. Here's the thing with Pharaoh, and I suspect maybe Esau along the way as well. Pharaoh was predisposed in many ways to having a hard heart. He was Egyptian. He was raised the way he was. It was in the culture, foreign gods, all of these types of things. He had a lot of understandable reasons to believe and think the way that he did. However, even though he had all those reasons and all that background and all those beliefs, it was not impossible for Pharaoh to change his heart and to place his faith in the one true God. Yet Pharaoh chose not to. God left Pharaoh to the condition of his heart. Pharaoh could have changed the condition of his heart at any time, but there are some people, there are some people who are never going to change their mind and never change their heart no matter what, right? And that was kind of Pharaoh, and God just left Pharaoh. Could God have made Pharaoh change his heart? Yeah. But if God made Pharaoh change his heart, would it have really been a genuine change of heart? Pharaoh came to a place of letting the people go to put an end to the plagues. He didn't let them go because he believed in God. He let them go to put an end to the plagues. And then when he let them go, he had second thoughts and said, holy cow, what did I do? Let's go get them. And he tried to go get them out because he didn't have a sincere, genuine change of heart. Again, back to the preview video or the intro video. Would you rather be invited to the party because the person really wanted you there or because their mom and dad said, no, you got to invite them? I don't know about you, but I'd rather be invited because they genuinely wanted me there. Now, if they invited me because mom and dad made them, I'm going to go there and make sure I get as much food as I can. So there are some who just refuse to listen, and God leaves them to the condition of their heart. But understanding that requires that I'm going to understand the thoughts and the minds of God. And I don't know about you, but I'm just not that good yet. All right. Well, then you might say, why does God blame people for not responding? Here's the second argument. The first was, isn't God being unfair? The second is, well, why does God blame people for not responding? Haven't they simply done what he makes them do? In other words, can Pharaoh be blamed for being Pharaoh? Can Esau be blamed for being Esau? Can Pharaoh be blamed for rejecting the appeal to let my people go? Because after all, God, you made him that way. You made him do it. Pharaoh could have changed at any moment. Pharaoh chose to reject. Pharaoh chose to refuse. Is that God's fault? I don't think so. All right. No. Don't say that. Who are you, a mere human being, to argue with God? Should the thing that was created say to the one who created it, why have you made me like this? And then we get into some really, really cool stuff. Go ahead. When a potter makes jars out of clay, doesn't he, the potter, have the right to use the same lump of clay to make one jar for decoration and another to throw garbage into? A lump of clay is a lump of clay. The lump of clay doesn't sit on the table and go, I want to be a pot for decoration. And another lump of clay go, I think I'll be a pot to throw garbage into. Who decides what the lump of clay becomes? Who sees the same lump of clay and envisions what it will be and envisions what it will become? Who is the one who takes the lump of clay and molds and shapes and forms and turns that lump of clay into what it's intended to be? And I know the movie Ghost has ruined this analogy for everyone, but just dismiss that. It is the potter. The lump of clay does not sit there and go, I want to be this, and you have to make me it. It is the potter who envisions and shapes and molds and creates it as it is intended to be. And the potter has a right to make a decorative jar and a trash can. Go ahead. In the same way, even though God has the right to show his anger and his power, and the reason he has the right to do it is because he is holy and just and fair and right, and we are not. We have broken covenant with God. We have broken relationship with God. We have continued to step outside of God's parameters. We have questioned. We have challenged. We have defied. We have rebelled, even if in our own way. And God has a right to display his anger and his power at any moment. But instead of doing that, he is very patient. The word that is there is long-suffering. Think about that. God suffers long in our sin. He is very long-suffering with those on whom his anger falls, who are destined for destruction. It's almost like God waits as long as he possibly can in hopes that they'll get it. It's almost like God puts up with our sin as long as he can, so that we could be made right with him. God is long-suffering. God is patient. Go ahead. He does this to make the riches of his glory shine even brighter on those to whom he shows mercy, who were prepared in advance for glory. Go ahead. And we are among those whom he selected from both the Jews and from the Gentiles. This is the first time in this part of Paul's letter where the Gentiles have been mentioned directly. Up until this point, he has only talked about the Jews. So now he goes and turns attention a little bit more to the Gentiles. Concerning the Gentiles, God says in the prophecy of Hosea, those who were not my people, I will now call my people, and I will love those whom I did not love before. There's an analogy to the Gentiles here that wasn't in the original prophecy of Hosea, but God uses this to make it. In Hosea, there were 10 tribes. So there are 12 tribes of Israel. And there were 10 around the time of the prophecy of Hosea that had wandered. And they had wandered so far that they had missed the mark completely. Even though they felt they were entitled, they were at risk of not being included, even to the point, of being considered, and this is the phrasing the Jewish people would have used, that they would have been considered like those Gentile heathen dogs. And so he says, those who were not my people, those who are at the risk of being excluded because they're not entitled, I will now call my people, because it's not about entitlement, it's about inclusion. And I will love those whom I did not love before. And then, at the place where they were told, you are not my people, there they will be called children of the living God. If God can restore a wandering Israel, what makes them think he cannot restore the Gentiles? Go ahead. And concerning Israel, now he comes back to Israel. Isaiah the prophet cried out, though the people of Israel are as numerous as the sand on the seashore. Where does that phrase sound familiar from? The promise that he made to Abraham, right? And the people of Israel are as numerous as the sand. So the promise is being fulfilled in that regard. Only a remnant will be saved. For the Lord will carry out his sentence upon the earth quickly and with finality. So though they are as numerous as the sands on the seashore, only a part of them will be made right with God. It will not be all of Israel. It will not be every Jewish individual. Not every Hebrew person will be considered and be included. Even though they feel entitled, there will only be a remnant. And that remnant will consist of those who, you tell me what they do to be made right with God. They place their trust in Jesus. It is about faith, not entitlement, right? All right, go ahead. And Isaiah said the same thing in another place. If the Lord of the heaven's armies had not spared a few of our children, we would have been wiped out like Sodom and Gomorrah. I would imagine that being compared to Sodom and Gomorrah was a pretty hard pill for the Jewish people to swallow. But God uses that here to point out that God has been patient, that God has been long-suffering, that God has given them every opportunity to understand and know and believe. Go ahead. What does all this mean? Even though the Gentiles were not trying to follow God's standards, they didn't know. They weren't even trying to follow God's standards. They were made right with God, and it was by faith that this took place. They weren't even trying. And the Jewish people were trying so hard to the law that they missed the mark. They were trying so hard by the law that they felt entitled, and they missed being included because they lost faith. They began to believe in the law more than they believed in God. They began to believe in their works more than they began to believe in God's grace. They began to rely on their own merits rather than faith. And then there were the Gentiles who weren't even trying to follow God's standard, and God opened the door wide to them through his grace and through faith, and they were made right with God by faith. Go ahead. But the people of Israel who tried so hard to get right with God by keeping the law never succeeded. They didn't have faith, though they had everything else. They had the promise. They had the law. They had the covenants, they had the ancestry, they had the tabernacle, they had the temple, and they had the opportunity to accept Jesus as the Messiah. They had all of that privilege. And they took that privilege and got it so distorted and messed up that they became entitled at the risk of being included. Why not? Why didn't they succeed? because they were trying to get right with God by keeping the law instead of by trusting in Him. They stumbled over the great rock in their path. It was right in front of them, and they stumbled over it. The stumbling block was faith in Jesus. And they stumbled over faith because of their belief in works. They stumbled over Jesus because of their perception of what the Messiah would and would not be. And then go on. God warned them of this in the scriptures when He said, "I am placing a stone in Jerusalem that makes people stumble, a rock that makes them fall. But anyone who trusts in Him," and so God is clearly identifying what the rock is, what the stumbling block is. "And there were some who accepted Jesus as the Messiah and made Him the cornerstone of their faith, and there are some who rejected and made Him a stumbling block. But anyone who trusts in Him will never be disgraced." Disgraced. Here's the thing. Every one of us faces the same decision. Will we try to be made right with God through some sense or some form of works and entitlement? Or will we accept the gift of being made right with God through His grace extended when Jesus became the sacrifice for the sin of humankind and defeated sin in His death and defeated death in His resurrection? I don't know about you, but if a sense of entitlement will risk my inclusion, I will sacrifice my entitlement and I will take included over entitled every single day. Let me pray for you this morning. Dear God, thank You for this time together. Thank You for this part of Paul's letter through which we can set aside some of our entitlement for inclusion. Thank You for all of the things that Paul points out about dismantling this illusion of entitlement and putting the pieces of the puzzle back together in a way in which we can understand how to be included. God, it is not about the law. It is not about heritage or ancestry. It is about the privilege of being a recipient of Your grace and placing our faith in that. And so my prayer today is, no matter where we are in the steps of our relationship with You, that this will help us take a step of inclusion because of faith and set aside any sense of entitlement to pursue relationship with You. For those who are well grounded in their faith, that they will dig a little deeper into assessing their own sense of entitlement. For those who are walking the journey in the newness or kicking the tires or exploring, that they will come to understand that it's not about anything they will do. It's about what Jesus has already done for them and has given to us as a gift. And they will receive that through faith. And for those anywhere in the middle, exploring it, trying to figure it out, trying to learn how not just to be made right with God, but to live right with God, that You would help us understand that it is putting one foot in front of the other in obedience to You. Not about being entitled, but about being included. We pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. Thank you for being here, for choosing to spend this part of your day with us. We'll roll the preview video for next Sunday. When that preview video is over, you're dismissed. It is supposed to be 55 degrees today. Get outside and go for a walk. Have a great rest of the day.